custody of EJB, Perry versus Bukema. I don't see anyone present in court. It appears to be counsel for that case. Maybe the marshal can go out and inquire if they're in the lobby area, and if so, we can begin early. If not, we'll take a short recess. Good morning. Good
morning, Your Honor.
We are running a bit ahead of schedule, which is probably an exception. But we had one of our arguments preceding yours canceled their oral argument opportunity, and so we didn't notify you of a change in schedule. But thank you for being here in advance. I think we've requested that the party show up in advance and this for this very purpose. So thank you very much. So the next matter on for oral argument is in the matter of the custody of EJB, Perry versus, is it Bukema or Bukema?
Bukema?
Yes. All right. Despite your effort to school me on that, I'm sure I'll mispronounce it. My apologies to the parties. Counsel, I'll just remind you of our rules as you're getting situated for the argument. The appellant will have 15 minutes for the presentation of the argument with an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, and of course the respondent will have 15 minutes in total. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and the clock in the podium, which you should be mindful of, and yellow indicates you've got 5 minutes left, and when red shows up, you should have stopped by then. The podium can be raised or lowered to match your height at your convenience. Please state your name as you begin each leg of the argument, because we keep track of the proceedings in our oral recording of the hearing. And that's it. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may take the podium.
All right, may it please the court. My name is Marcus Beyer, and I am the attorney for the appellant, Israel Perry. The parties to this family court litigation have never married. They have one son together, initials EJB. He was born on March 21st of 2007, currently age 12. My client, the appellant father, lives in the city of Willits, California, where he's employed as a chiropractor, and the respondent mother lives in Rochester, Minnesota, where she is employed as a nurse practitioner. Prior litigation has established that the mother has sole legal and sole physical custody of the minor child, and my client's father has parenting time of about 60 overnights per year, which he exercises primarily in California. There's been some prior litigation that brings us here today that was heard first in 2016, 2017, and then finally in 2018. The 16 and 17 motions were reserved, heard by the court in 18, which resulted in the order that is subject of this appeal. There had been some parenting time issues. There was a parenting time expediter appointed, and the mom had changed, or she had changed employment, got a new job, or got a job after schooling.
So I can take you right to the issues. I think sure. We're aware of the background. So both parties, am I correct, in the proceeding that got us here, both parties had a request for the child support.
Correct, yes.
So who had the burden of establishing what exactly is the community that we're talking about under the statute, and what is the prevailing income in that community? Who carried that burden?
Well, it was, I guess, technically a motion to modify. Both parties were seeking to modify the obligation. I guess you could, from that perspective, argue both parties would have a burden to establish that.
I thought so, too. So let's assume, just for the sake of my question, that we agree with you that the district court erred by not precisely or narrowly defining what is the community. What evidence in the record can you identify to show that your client was prejudiced by that error? How do we know, or how can we possibly conclude that the $7,000 income amount is less favorable than an accurate and proper determination of what the community is and what the income is in that community for your client for potential income purposes?
Well, the previous income that had been set, which was also on the basis of potential income, was $3,000 per
month. Right, but you've said the community has to be Willits. Is it
correct?
Willits?
Yes, yes.
And that was based on a community other than Willits. So why would that be any more or less speculative than or arbitrary than the $7,000 figure?
I mean, he moved to Willits in 2013, and there were subsequent orders following that when he was residing in Willits. So my understanding, and I didn't represent him in any of the underlying litigation, but from what I've reviewed in the record, is that this $3,000 a month figure has been in place since approximately 2013 when he was living in Willits.
That number didn't come from Willits, a measure of potential earning in Willits, correct?
My reading of it is that it's a number that the court essentially decided on its own, that this is, he was making $2,000 a month at the time. The argument was that he's underemployed, he can be making more. The court settled on $3,000 a month. I'm not aware that that was based on any empirical evidence as to what somebody can be making in Willits.
Why is that any more compelling? That gets back to my point. You're saying that the community of Willits determines what the proper income potential income should be. Am I correct that your client did not introduce any more specific evidence of Willits community income for chiropractors of your client's level of expertise, background, education, experience than did your opponent?
No, I don't think there's anything in the record that says here's what my other chiropractors in Willits make.
So how could we possibly say that the error harmed your client if we don't know if your client didn't introduce a better, more favorable potential income basis?
Well, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, and we're now in front of the Court of Appeals, I mean, that I understand the court's point, but at the time when the motion was brought, the court had previously, he was, if you want to say, the rule of the law of the case. I mean, he was bringing what the court had previously found his income to be. He was making, in fact, $2,150 per month when he brought the motion, but nevertheless was accepting the court's prior finding that he made $3,000 per month. So that's
he accepted the court's determination that potential income had to be determined, and you've accepted for your argument an appeal that the three statutory methods are the options available, and one of those options is the one relied upon by the district court, accurately or not, was the potential income of the community that you say isn't narrow enough. So I understand that your point is, well, with hindsight, maybe we would have introduced that evidence, but now, today, on what basis, on what factual basis, what evidentiary basis would we say, or could we say, this error harmed the appellant?
Well, the court is saying that he now makes $7,000 per month. I mean, there's no evidence in the record to show that.
The court isn't saying that he makes $7,000 per month. The court's saying that that's his potential income.
Correct.
Earning income. And there's a difference there. And father did introduce evidence from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that showed a national average of approximately 83,350 in 2017, which equates to approximately $7,000 a month. So it appears that the district court relied on the information that father offered and in his affidavit said that is more reliable than the information offered by mother. So how can he now argue that he's prejudiced when it appears the district court relied on, you know, did the best it could with the information it had before it.
That information from Mr. Perry was submitted in response to the information that Mother had submitted, which was from Santa Rosa, which was significantly higher income. And he offered that not to show that this is what my income is, and it should be, or could be, and it should be, child support should be calculated consistent with that income. He offered that to show that the numbers submitted by Mom and her affidavit were not accurate.
And the way that you'd say that they're not accurate is because these are more accurate numbers.
That's, the affidavit says what it says, and I think that
so why wouldn't the district court have a basis to rely upon those numbers? And I while you answer that, I'd like you to answer another part of that question, which is, you said a minute ago, well, the Santa Rosa numbers were substantially higher. Higher than what?
Higher than the numbers that were in the exhibit that was offered by
but
Mr.
Why does
Kurt?
That matter? If you're saying that it's the community of Willits that matters, and Santa Rosa must be higher than Willits, how do we know that from the evidence presented? How do we know that the actual potential income shouldn't have been $9,000 a month or $10,000 a month?
Well, in the end, there's nothing in the record to show what the income is in Willits.
That's the problem I've got with your position, which is you're asking us to reverse based upon an assumption about a finding that was not made because neither party, including your party, which you acknowledge had the burden or shared the burden to present evidence. How could we possibly reverse?
I guess that's a risk that Mr. Perry takes, that if this court were to remand the matter back to district court to receive to open the record for information.
Why? On what basis would we reopen the record when both parties had the opportunity, both parties had the burden, as you've acknowledged, to present evidence of the community? Your client knew, obviously, that there was some economic data that's being provided about which your client disagreed as representative of the community. So everything was there for your client to present to the district court more accurate numbers if you think the numbers are not precise enough. So why would we, on what basis would we say, go ahead and take another bite at the apple on remand?
Well, as we've indicated, the respondent is also is the party who advanced the argument that his income should be higher than the $3,000 per month that the court has previously found his income to be.
You're arguing that was error that prejudiced your client.
Correct.
And if we don't have evidence in the record that your client was prejudiced, on what basis, what legal theory would we reverse and remand for more inquiry?
I think it's implicit in the fact that he's appealing that he believes that his income is, in fact,
I know what he believes, but we have to base our determination of error and harm and prejudice on evidence in the record.
Well, there's what he actually makes, for one thing. That there's a record in his affidavit, he states his actual income.
You've already acknowledged that you presented to the district court that, okay, we're willing not to use that number. We're willing to base it on potential income. So now we're in the potential income basket, aren't we?
Well, yes, and I guess at the end of the day, what it comes back to is the fact that there's this 5,000, it goes from 3,000 to 5,000 to 6,000 to 7,000, that those are numbers that are not based on anything that's in the record to support those figures. And the court obviously was of the opinion that he can be making more than what he makes. He lives in a town of about 5,000 people that's 85 miles away from Santa Rosa. It's a rural area in Northern California. That has a different standard of living than what we might be accustomed to here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
That's what we don't know. That's my problem. You're saying that there's this difference between Willits and Santa Rosa, and I'm looking for something in the record to support that proposition other than just, well, they're 85 miles apart. I mean, it may be that they're 85 miles apart, and Willits is a more exclusive community than Santa Rosa. We just don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
more affluent.
I mean, nor is there anything in the record there's nothing, your point being that there's nothing in the record to suggest that it would be lower than $7,000, nor is there anything in the record to suggest that it's higher than $7,000.
You're right.
Higher than $3,000.
How does that help your cause when you're the one you're the one asserting that the district court erred in a way that harmed your client? The burden was on both parties, and on appeal, isn't the burden on your client to show evidence in the record to establish prejudice?
The evidence is, in the record here is actually lack of evidence, again, that the Kaczynski case, the Culver case, which are cited in the brief, those cases stand for the notion that if we're going to say somebody's voluntarily underemployed and we're going to use potential income as a result, that income has to be based upon the community where they reside. We don't have that information in here. So to say that he makes $5,000, $6,000, or $7,000 per month, it's just not. I think the case implicit with the cases that I've cited is that, you know, in those cases it involved a situation where somebody lived here in the Twin Cities and they relocated.
What was the district court supposed to do? That the respondent provides information and says, well, here's Santa Rosa, here's San Francisco. What's the district court supposed to do at that point?
I think the court would say, I don't have any information to see the existing fact pattern, where the fact that would have been made was that his income is $3,000 per month. I don't see anything in here that shows me that his income is in fact or potentially could be higher than $3,000 per month. So it has to, absent that information, it has to stay at $3,000 per month.
Where in the law does it say that?
Well, if my mother is seeking to modify child support and she's seeking a higher obligation, she has a burden of...
Except father agreed that it should be determined based on potential income.
If only because the court had previously made that in a previous ruling that hadn't been appealed, that the court, that he was at $3,000 per month. And that was when, obviously, people decide to appeal or not to appeal for any number of reasons, and the income, the difference between $2,000 and $3,000 a month, he made the decision to not appeal that.
But in this case, there's no appeal. In this case, it was acknowledged, if I read the briefing, that it's okay not to go with the actual income number that husband, that father offered, and it's okay to go with potential income. I thought that was conceded in the district court's analysis in this case.
But then we still must look to the income in the community, and mother hasn't established or met her burden of proving that it's $5,000, $6,000, or $7,000.
But you're the district court judge. What do you do? Mother says, hey, I've got information. The closest I could find is a community that's 85 miles away. So use that. What's the district court supposed to do then? To say it's not really the community?
The statute says the community. In case laws would suggest Santa Rosa, the entire state of California is not the community.
Well, it wasn't the entire state of California. It was Santa Rosa. Do you agree that it at least is reasonable for a district court to make some extrapolation based upon a community that's 85 miles away?
I do not, no. And I agree. What I was prepared to argue here today is that it does put the court in a... if this were to be remanded for further findings as to what the probable earnings levels are in the city of Willits, that's not necessarily an easy undertaking.
But in Culver versus Culver, in the unpublished opinion of this court, they said that 100 miles, they remanded for further evidence because in between the appellate decisions, the new spouse, was commuting 100 miles.
Well,
and that wasn't viewed as so out of bounds of whatever the word community and the statute means that...
My reading of the Culver case the court is referencing was ex-husband remarried, his new wife relocated to Penick, and the court said Penick is not the same community as the Twin Cities. So we're going to look at the income in Penick. We're not going to look at the income in the Twin Cities. He had been making $17.50 per hour in the Twin Cities in the printing industry. His new job that he got in Penick was only $10 per hour. And the district court said, basically created this problem yourself by this move. You're voluntarily underemployed. We're not modifying the obligation. The Court of Appeals said in Culver was, it stretches the definition of community to say that Penick, 100 miles away, and Culver are the same community. So we have to look to what the income is in Culver, in Penick, and it got remanded for that purpose. So there is precedent within this court for remanding back to the district court to receive information as to what the probable earnings levels are in that community despite in both of those cases, as the moving party, it would have been the obligor's obligation to say, here's where I don't live in the Twin Cities not anymore. I now live in Kentucky in the Kaczynski case, or I now live in Penick in the Culver case. Here's what I can or should be, here's what I could be making in.
Didn't that already happen in this? I thought that's what happened in this case, where your client says, no, Santa Rosa is not the, that's not the community, it's Willits. So there's the moment. So why remand when that circumstance?
Because that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened in Kaczynski and in Culver, where to extend the court's logic here, in those cases, in theory, the obligor could have presented information to the court about here's what I could be making in Kentucky as a secretary in the Kaczynski case. Court that still got remanded because the wife in that case no longer resided in Minnesota. She resided in Kentucky.
And the difference between Kentucky and Minnesota as communities, I it's sort of a given that these are objectively different, necessarily different. In this case, you've got the largest community around, the closest community, was presented. Evidence was presented regarding Santa Rosa.
Santa Rosa is not
the difference in Kentucky and the Twins and Minnesota.
Well, I think the better analogy then would be the Culver case, where it's the Twin Cities and a rural community of Penick, 100 miles away, similar distance between the distance of Willits and Santa Rosa. And Santa Rosa is a city of 175,000 people. It's much bigger than the city of Willits.
We've taken you well beyond your time, but I want to make sure, Judge Cochran, I think, had a couple of questions. I want to make sure they get asked.
I think they've been answered.
Okay, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is David Vanderhayden. I represent Rachel Bokima. Our view is that the district court, in a well-reasoned, thoughtful decision that should be affirmed by this court, because appellant has failed to demonstrate that the facts in the record do not support the decision, nor that the findings are not supported by Minnesota law. To answer your question, Your Honor, about what's the district court to do, I would respectfully suggest to the court that a motion for amended findings or conclusions would have been appropriate with respect to assisting the district court in if any additional assistance was required, and that is why we have a relaxed or lessened standard of review here with respect to whether there's evidence to support the findings and whether there's the findings support the conclusions and are the conclusions consistent with law. And I would respectfully suggest that that is precisely the case you have before you.
Can I poke at some things I didn't?
Sure.
The district court found, I think this is finding 46, both he and his wife, owners of the business, are settled into the into and part of the community. If they cannot make a living, one or both of them should be looking for other employment outside their business area. And it says, I think somewhere else, that there's plenty of time for them to be established and potentially to be making more money. I didn't see any support for that proposition in the record.
Judge,
I think that was an
Judge, I'm glad you brought that up because
appropriate analysis.
I'm glad you brought that up because this case is distinguishable from the other cases that counsel brought before you, because in this case we have long-standing findings of underemployment by this father with respect to his income. This goes back years before or at about the time he moved to Willits, as early as 2013, Your Honors, he was found to be underemployed in Willits. This record is replete with consideration for his station in Willits. For years, courts and magistrates have been looking at what his income was. Oftentimes, my client was unrepresented before the magistrate, as was the father. But the magistrates and the district court judges, starting in 2011, were looking at his income and his underemployment. And some of those findings
are... Remind us how the $3,000 potential income level was established.
Pardon me, Your Honor.
Well, you said there have been a number of findings in past proceedings regarding his earning potential and his ability to, or his work as a chiropractor. And in a prior order, $3,000 per month was established as his potential income. Can you remind us how that number was arrived at?
Yes. If you... Your Honor, at Addendum 4, there's an order. It's dated October 30th, 2014. And finding 19 in that order, the factual basis for the order was as follows. The CSM reiterated her previous findings as to father's underemployment by continuing to work as an associate chiropractor for his girlfriend, earning $2,000 per month, and determined that given his education, employment history, father had the ability to earn at least $3,000 per month, Your Honor, and that was as early as October 30th of 2014.
So what was the community for purposes of determining that amount?
Willits.
And
he's talking about...
What do you argue is the... How should the term community be interpreted for purposes of his potential income?
Judge, I think the term community is factually dependent on the facts in the case and the evidence the trial court has before it. They obviously want a very restricted definition and interpretation of community. My client wants a broader definition of community. And I believe this goes back to my point about underemployment. His community, Willits, has been considered by this court from as far back as 2013. It was nothing new. Every judicial officer that this came before considered what he had going in Willits and found that he was underemployed. None of the other cases cited Culver, Kuczynski, those are not underemployment cases that the obligor had been determined historically to be underemployed. Big distinction. In this case, he's underemployed as early as 2013 in Willits.
Help me to understand the basis in the record for the district court to jump from 3,000 to 7,000 in just about a period of 3 or 4 years. As the
Judge,
potential income. If the potential income was accurate at $3,000, I don't know of a profession, including chiropractic, that would suggest that an individual who has 3 years of experience doubles his income potential.
Judge, if you look at the finding 42 in the order, it talks about his historical background and training. In 2011, he started at Hammer Chiropractic. He was earning $3,000 a month, Your Honor, in 2011.
I understand that.
His first job, right out of school, essentially right out of school, not maybe exactly out of school, but at the start of his career, he's earning $3,000.
But the point is, a few years later, $3,000 was still the potential income the court found for him. In Willits, you said.
Well, in 2013.
Right.
Okay.
So what's the basis other than...
And, Judge, I would respectfully suggest to the court that arguments were made that it shouldn't have been $3,000 at those times. The court took a conservative approach to that, gave him the benefit of the doubt, but then as more and more motions to modify, what he was doing, Your Honor, was moving to modify when my client, who's a nurse practitioner, increased her earnings on her employment track. Every time she got any more income, he filed a motion. But every time...
What evidence in the record supports the specific monthly potential income in 49A, B, C, and D?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
So in paragraph 49A, the court finds a potential income of $3,000 per month. I'm trying to get back to Judge Ross's question. In paragraph B, the court finds a potential income of $5,000 per month from October 1, 2017 through December 31, 2017. Then for the year of 2018, the court finds $6,000 per month, and in 2019, $7,000 per month. What evidence in the record supports that?
Judge, what I think is the referee finally exercised appropriately discretion to make a finding of what his potential income was based on the history in the record and the evidence that was just before it. I'll take you back, Your Honor, to finding number 44, where Mother provided the court with a multitude of information as employment for wages for chiropractors with varying levels of experience for various resources areas, including nationally, Minnesota, California, and elsewhere, along with Santa Rosa, as Judge Ross pointed out, 85 miles from Willits, for total compensation, health and retirement, $143,000 to $220,000 a year. That's what chiropractors make. And with an average compensation of $159,000. He's half of, I suggested to the court, why don't we do it this time? Give him $159,000. My client's not happy with the finding with respect to his $83,000 income. We think we accepted it, we didn't appeal it, but we think it should have been $159,000, and we argued it. But to get to your question, at 46, Your Honor, to get to Judge Ross's question, Father has been, the court carefully considered all this. This is another bite off the apple. This is coming back, asking this appellate court to do some of the work appellant could have done before this court. The court was persuaded that she had heard enough that this guy's potential income is far in excess of the $3,000 that was found in 2013. He got a break all the way along. We think he's still getting a break, but there's evidence to support considerably more. The court exercised discretion than what the court actually did. And at 46, the court took her time. Father has been a chiropractor for 8 years. He's an experienced, quote-unquote, chiropractor, has resided in Willits for 5 years. Both he and his wife should have had enough time to your question, Judge Ross, about professionally, how can you expect someone to make that sort of jump? This district court, this referee, considered that for 5 years, and both he and his wife should have had enough time to build up the practice. In his November 21st, 2018 affidavit, Father stated that his business now offers DOT physicals and will soon be adding seasonal employer drug testing. Both he and his wife, owner of the business, are settled into and part of the community. If they cannot make a living, one or both of them should be looking at other employment outside the area or the business area. That goes to this underemployment, along with the imputation of potential income. We have a person who is underemployed since at least 2013 in Willits. The court thoroughly considered his station in Willits.
Let me ask you a procedural question. Let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with appellant in this case, Mr. Bukema, that the statute's reference to community is narrowly determined, not statewide, not 85 miles away. Let's assume we agreed with that. Would we have to reverse and remand? Why not?
Because there's other factors listed in subsection 1 under methods. The court, as appropriate, determination of potential income must be made according to one of the following three methods.
Well, let's assume that the court that the court applied the method of this, the first method, which regards community, and that we're going to hold the court to that, would we have to reverse?
No, because I think there's sufficient other, I think the court did address his community in Willits. But if the court were to conclude that community is defined as narrowly to just include Willits, I still don't think that requires a reversal, because the court considered a multitude of other factors listed in subsection 1, namely the potential recent work history, occupational qualifications in light of prevailing job opportunities, i.e. Santa Rosa, and earning levels in the community. I don't think if the court were to conclude that Willits is the community under that, and the court failed to look at Willits, I don't think that's sufficient to reverse and remand this case in light of all the other evidence.
My question was, I guess, maybe not teed up enough to get a response to what I was dealing with earlier, this question of prejudice. In order for us to reverse, we have to find that this was not just a harmless error. Is there enough in this record, if we thought the district court was wrong and erred in considering community too broadly, is there enough in the record for us to say that the error was anything but harmless?
I think there is enough in the record, Your Honor, because of what I just mentioned about my client thought her income should have been $159. This is still a reasonable determination based on the evidence that this referee had before her and made a very lengthy and thoughtful findings to support its decision, which was several pages long. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
I don't know that you've got to the question of prejudice. Is there enough for us to reverse? I mean, I'm struggling as a matter of procedure as to whether or not, if the district court erred, we have enough to say, well, not only did the district court erred, but it prejudiced the appellant.
I would say there is not any, it is not of sufficient magnitude, if there is any prejudice, to warrant reversal in light of the opportunity the appellant had, the same opportunity the appellant had, and the careful consideration that the referee made of all the evidence that was in the record to support its her decision.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Counsel for the appellant, you have time for rebuttal if you'd like to.
Yes, please.
Any further?
Your Honor, if I understood the court's question to counsel correctly, the dealing with if the court were to agree that with the notion that the concept of community is more narrow and that doesn't include Santa Rosa, is there anything else in the record that allows for that prevents a reversal? And I think if you look to the first clause of the 518A.32 sub 1, I'll just read it in its entirety. It says the parents, there's one of three methods includes the parent's probable earnings level based on employment potential, recent work history, and occupational qualifications in light of prevailing job opportunities and earnings levels in the community. You know, in some of these other cases, the party had a history of making more money. And so that would be recent work history. If he had actually had a history of making $7,000, that would be a basis for the court to say, we're going to rely on your recent work history, and that's how we're going to stay with $7,000. There's nothing in the record here. In fact, the record is to the contrary, that the most income he's ever had, whether it's potential income or actual income, is this $3,000 figure. So I would submit that when you read that statute, there's nothing in the record that would allow for the court to say, yeah, this was okay for the court to determine that this was your potential income. And the counsel in his brief had cited the Bratz case, and I think that one is distinguishable because there the court, the obligor lived in Georgia, he's left the military, went to school, and sought a reduction because he didn't have that job anymore. There the court just said, you didn't move, you still live in the same community, and you have a history of making the money that we're assigning to you for purposes of potential income. Again, that's not what we have here. There's no history of Mr. Perry ever making the income that the court assigned to him here. You know, in living here and, again, in...
Right, but I don't know if that helps your cause since the... That's because there was a finding that your client was intentionally underemployed.
Well...
So it makes sense that there wasn't a record of your client.
Well, to go back to the prior questioning of the both me and counsel, the prior order made a finding that he was, I think from 2014, while he was living in Willits, said, you say your income is $2,000, we think you're voluntarily underemployed, we're going to use $3,000. That was while living in Willits. Mm-hmm. So to get back to the question of burden and that, and the respondent has not offered any evidence to suggest that other than this Indeed.com and Salary.com from Santa Rosa, that he could be making more money. I think what's behind all of this is everybody just thinks, well, you're a chiropractor, you should be making more money. Well, we need more than just a subjective opinion based on statistical information we pull from the internet.
But shouldn't your client have presented that information at the hearing?
He didn't ask the court to make changes with respect to his income. The court had made a previous finding with respect to his income.
Well,
so the court was, my client was willing to accept that. So he was not seeking to modify the finding with respect to his income.
But he did ask that the reserved issues be decided, and this was one of the reserved issues. So he knew the court was going to be addressing the issue. And he was aware of the applicable statutory language.
Income is a major factor when we determine child support. So of course that's always relevant, one's income. But I think what's fair to say, what happened here is that the facts had already been found that this was his income, and he was not asking the court to make changes to that.
But somebody else was. So and produce evidence to support it.
She brought that up, and so my client was, as the pleadings were presented, my client was the initial moving party. Mom responded, and she brought that up in response.
A motion of her own?
Yes.
So address the standard of review in light of a failure to move the district court for amended findings. How does that affect our standard of review and the level of deference we give to the district court's analysis?
Well, I believe the not moving for amended findings goes to the scope of review and as far as what you can consider, which would be scope of review versus standard of review, and scope of, you know, kind of the difference between what we look at versus how we look at it. And I believe that regardless of the scope of review, the standard of review is still a clearly erroneous standard, in that if maybe my client's position that it was clear error or that it was clearly erroneous when the district court here set the income levels that it did for Mr. Perry and then the child support obligations that flowed from it. And I do see that my time is up.
With one final question, unless my colleagues have other questions for you. In one sentence, what would we say? How would we conclude this sentence? The district court erred in broadly construing the concept of community under the statute, and we know that the error prejudiced the appellant because what evidence would we cite to finish that sentence?
Because there's no evidence in the record to support the income level higher than the court had already found for him, but based on previous findings of underemployment in the city of Willits. Perhaps I'm not saying that as artfully as I could, but...
Well, I don't know if that answers the question, which is, what is the evidence that we would cite to say that your client, the result that your client received from this order is less favorable than your client would have received if the proper community would have been identified and the numeric data was provided as to that community?
Because this obligation assumes an income for him that increases his child support obligation from what he's currently ordered to pay. I mean, if the court's coming back to we're kind of going what we covered in the first round, which was he didn't present evidence that says here's what there's one other chiropractor in town. Here's what the other chiropractor makes. He didn't have that information. He relied on the data that the previous finding as to what his income was, and again, I think that was already found. And that's implicit. They're understood. The reason why he's bringing this child, this motion for appeal, I should say, is because he believes that if the record were open and the court were to receive information on what the income is in Willits, that it would be lower. And again, to the burden issue, the court had already established his income at $3,000 on underemployment in Willits, and mom didn't present any information to rebut that.
Can I ask just one quick question?
Sure.
So looking at paragraph 32 in the order, on October 4, 2017, your client made a motion to amend child support. So, and it looks like, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, that was reserved then, and then your client then asked that the court resolve it, so that the evidence in the record before the court presented by your client were his tax returns showing what he was filing on his tax returns for income, and then the national average for a chiropractor. So your client presented no evidence of community, even though that portion of it was your client's motion, correct? I mean, your client presented national...
That was in the...
A national average.
So you're referring to the 2017 motion. There was a subsequent motion that was filed in 2018. And it was in the 2018 motion when he presented information from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showing what chiropractors make nationwide.
But my point in referencing October 4 is that issue, that motion, was held in reserve. And then it was your client that put it on in 2018 saying, no, I should be paying even less. And your client presented evidence... The tax returns are in the record, and a national average, correct?
I don't know that the tax returns. I don't have the underlying pleadings from the 2017 motion in front of me. But I didn't represent him then. But I mean, obviously, if you're presenting tax returns, I think it's to show what my actual income is. My client would have, frankly, have no problem whatsoever if the court were to use his actual income in determining child support. But I think that ship has sailed in the court. I mean, that's a whole other question, I think, really, as to whether or not we should be using actual income or potential income when we have somebody who's working full time.
Well, there's not another question because you've waived that.
Your
argument assumes that the district court was correct in ascribing potential income. Judge Cochran, I think, had another question.
I just wanted to clarify your statement about the $3,000 per month level that had previously been established, and the basis for that. I had a recollection from reading the record that father worked in near the San Francisco area and made $3,000 per month in that area.
Correct. Yes.
And so it was my understanding in reading this order that the $3,000 per month was based on that $3,000 level that he had previously been earning in the San Francisco area, because in the child support history portion of the order at paragraph 8, it said father had begun employment as a chiropractor in California earning a gross monthly income of $3,000. And then in... paragraph 11, father continued to be employed as a chiropractor, earning a gross monthly income of $3,000. And then his 14A, his contract was not renewed, and he began employment with his significant other in a small town of California, decreasing his monthly earnings to $2,000. So in my reading of the order, it sounded like he was making $3,000 when he worked near San Francisco, and then when he moved to Willits, he started earning less in the nature of $2,000 and going up from
Correct.
There. But it appears to me that this $3,000 potential earning level is based on the amount that he earned when he was working in the San Francisco area, on Willett's.
That may have been where the number first came from, where it was first established, but if, I think this was, council addressed this in his comments, if you look to 19A, by this time he'd moved to Willett's.
Right.
And the court went back to, he said, even though 19A, you're making $2,000 per month, the court said, even, you know, we're going to assume in Willett's that your income is now $3,000.
But that's what I'm missing. Where does it say that that was in Willett's? It just says father had the ability to earn at least $3,000 per month. But is there somewhere in the record that it reflects that that's based on Willett's?
Well, 14A, father's previous chiropractic employment contract was not renewed at this other clinic, and he began employment with a significant other who later became his wife. In a small town in California, I think it's, I can read between the lines, and I think that's a move to Willett's.
Right.
And that's, so now as of at least 14A going forward, if not before, sometime sequentially, he's now in Willett's, and he's been living there, and council acknowledged himself, and since 2013 at least. So when we get to 19A, the status quo as far as where he's living is Willett's.
Isn't one way to interpret that, to assume that perhaps the district court simply treated California as the entire community, whether he moved to Willett's or was still living up north around San Francisco, that the $3,000 is what he was making? We're going to include that as potential income going forward.
That's probably a fair, in the absence of information to the contrary, that's a fair reading, yes.
But in any event, that was a number from 2014.
Yes.
And we're now several years later.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you to both counsel. Thank you for being here early. We didn't, we ended up having you both stand at the podium a lot longer than your period. Hopefully we were equal opportunity in our holding you to answer further questions, and you both extended over the time, but we appreciate your willingness to do so to help clarify things from the record and in the arguments. We appreciate your briefing and your oral argument. We will issue the opinion within the statutory period. This is the last case on our oral calendar for today, so we are in recess.